This is the Senate Committee on Labor, Consumer, and Business Affairs, meeting in Hearing Room B, no, pardon, Hearing Room A, at 1 o'clock p.m. on Tuesday, June the 7th.
They're really getting to them, but it makes the same as a red tag. It would be red tagged if there was a APD there, and they know damn well the safety device is removed.
The problem is they're having the fact that no one knows, one, if the guy's repairing a thing.
Well, we got that in the bill.
Okay, the second thing is there's no definition of safety equipment. Problem is, what if you decide the housing or something? That's the housing with 10 pieces of safety equipment.
How about if we worked out a definition of safety equipment?
I thought you all met with Glenn, because Glenn told me you had it worked out. Didn't you tell him you did? If you don't loosen up, you don't didn't agree with him, you better go tell him.
No, I told him I told him Senator Groner still went along with it. I would consider it possible, but I that he was still
for a bit. You know what brought it back?
In fact, I've got the same thing.
But I don't think the funding graduate works as that one
nurse. One down, right?
I'm ready, Senator.
We got two down, one to go.
Are you a collector of antiques, Ted? Are you a collector of antiques?
Yeah, I saw you sitting across there. I sat in my wet sport coat, steaming.
Isn't it terrible?
No. He told me he never agreed with it. He said it, but I wouldn't have agreed with it.
That's too bad. Ours is too long.
I wish you could, if this is a problem, you should explain or maybe an amendment. Okay.
Looks like his dad. Gosh, I should have. I recognize your daughter. Your daughter looks like your wife.
Yeah,
like
Louise.
I want to take
See, there were four drummers. One was Oriental fellow. I played the timpani. There was a short blonde. There was he not looking fellow. Yeah.
Meeting will come to order. The first bill we're here this morning or this afternoon is House Bill 2652, and we're pleased to have with us today Representative Theodore Kulongoski.
Speak for yourself, man.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson, members of the committee.
Did you hear that statement?
No, sir.
Move on.
He said speak for yourself, and I said it was a privilege to have you with us today.
You know, Senator, I was really beginning to have more respect for Senator Carson because he voted to send the guest passenger repeal out today.
Well,
and he's just lost all respect.
Is that right?
Like everybody says, Carson isn't all bad.
No, well,
mostly
just part of it.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 2652 is a bill that I introduced at the request of the gentleman sitting next to me. And if most of you have ever traveled the highway from Elkton, or should say Drain, over to Reedsport, you have gone along the highway, and in Elkton, there's a general store there called Arlene's. And the gentleman sitting next to me is the proprietor of Arlene's Cafe. The particular bill addresses a situation that was brought to his attention because apparently he is an antique collector of gambling machines, slot machines. And the bill, in essence, is one that is copied very closely from the California law, that which basically says that you can collect these machines as antiques. And under the present criminal code, you are not allowed to do that. Now, the significance of the 1941 date, as I have found out, and I'm going to turn it over to the person, individual that really is most concerned about the bill, is the fact that prior to 1941, they were all mechanical devices. And 1941 was the first year they started adding lights and electrical equipment and all those things to it. I don't think there's any question in the testimony before the committee in the House from the Revenue Department and everyone else is that prior to this time they are considered antiques. There are a number of publications that are going to be handed out to you today concerning this. And so I would ask that you give it your closest attention.
Chairman?
Yes.
I have a question for the senator or for the representative, because because he was a lawyer and he knows something about the use of this term, but the definition of a slot machine says gambling device shall be conclusively presumed an antique slot machine that was manufactured before 41. I wonder if disputably might not be better there, simply because it is conceivable, not that this gentleman would ever do it, but somebody else might utilize these old ones to actually conduct gambling.
Well,
and if it's disputably, then you can get at them if they do that.
Senator, that was discussed in the Labor Committee, Judiciary Committee in the House, and there was one amendment. I don't know if you have it in your bill, but it says on page 2 of the printed line, line 16, delete, while in the defendant's possession.
Yeah, we have it.
So that first sentence, though, I think covers the situation that you're concerned about.
Sure.
And it's, go ahead.
20
Carson.
Could I try the same thing? Ted, I think what Senator Trill is getting at, and I would kind of concur, let's see if I follow the bill correctly. Right now, you can't possess or use a gambling device. You can't possess a gambling device. Step one is a 1940 or earlier slot machine is conclusively presumed to be an antique slot machine, and then sentence one says an antique slot machine is not a gambling device. Do you run a problem there? I mean, or I say it's not a gambling device. It's not a gambling device. You can't bring a charge on it, so it has the effect of saying it's uncharged.
Okay, Senator, if I am correct, correct me on the criminal procedures. What would happen is that the district attorney would file a complaint charging you with possession of a gambling device.
Right.
You would answer. And in essence, I think that that's what it would be. It's almost in the nature of an affirmative defense.
I think so, yeah.
That what you would do is you would say, yes, but it's prior to 41, and it was not used, because if you read line 15 and 16, it was not operated for purposes of unlawful gambling.
Okay.
Now, what would happen at that particular time is if the state had evidence that, in fact, it was used for gambling, I think that's
and block the defense.
It would block the defense, and then it would be brought in. Now, I think what I understand the argument you're making with the word conclusively versus a disputable presumption.
Why don't we just leave both of those out? Just say presumed.
Well, Mr. Chairman. I've interrupted you. Why are we're going to antique only for the purpose of that's the kind of, unless you're going to use it, only the collectors would pick it up, and you're not going to collect the 1973 pinball machine just for the sheer joy of having the lights and sort of thing. So I suspect we're trying to define why do we even presume it? Why don't we say what I'm getting at, I'll restate it. The presumption assumes that it was either rebuttable or conclusive. If we're saying what's antique, for instance, we say antique cars sometimes are cars made more than 25 years ago. We just say they're antique. We don't presume they're antique. We just say they're antique. Well, what would be wrong with just saying any slot machine made assumed prior to 1941, which would be 1944, or earlier, is antique? Then we get around to conclusively presumed.
In other words, just make a statement that
well, what I'm getting at, when you say something's antique, why presume it?
In other words, you say a slot machine or gambling device shall be,
particularly when you say it's conclusively presumed.
Slot machine or gambling device that was manufactured prior to
1940. Why do we say a slot machine older than 1940 or 41.
Would it be a slot machine or gambling device shall be an antique slot machine or gambling device if it was manufactured prior to 41.
You could put
a slot machine or gambling device manufactured prior to 1941 is an antique slot machine or gambling device.
How about the word, Senator, if I could, that line six, the last sentence would read, a slot machine or gambling device shall be deemed an antique slot machine or gambling device if it was manufactured prior to 1941.
Well, I may be
saying very legalistic word.
It seems to me we're finding legislatively that everything built prior to 1941 is antique, because that's the triggering mechanism to make the first sentence work.
That's correct.
Okay, so why don't I, if that makes any sense, and if you'd said disputably, I presume you'd get into the evidence that maybe something made in 1939 really isn't antique, but I don't know how to fight that. If the threshold is anything made prior to 1941 is going to be deemed antique, why don't we just say it? And don't even say deemed, that is legalistic. That is antique.
Okay, I have no problem with that. Slot machine or gambling device.
Made or manufactured prior to 1941 is an antique slot machine and or gambling device.
How would that read then, Wally? A slot machine or gambling device
manufactured prior to 1941 is an antique slot machine or antique gambling device.
Okay, that'd be better.
Yeah.
Right. Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Senator.
This is probably really nitpicking, but are you sure you want to say 1941 or 1942? Probably it occurs to me that they were not manufactured after World War One started, for a period of probably 5 or 6 years. They're probably none manufactured. They probably manufactured during 1941 up until the war started.
Senator, I'm going to turn this over to this gentleman who has much more knowledge about that than I do. Jim, why don't you take it here? Yes, go ahead. Why don't you talk to him just briefly, and then you can work it out. And I'm going to sit up here with Senator Carson, see if I can work that language out.
My name is Jim Vasey. I'm a lifelong resident of Oregon and currently the owner of Farley's Cafe in Elkton, Oregon. Most of my adult life, I've been an antique collector with special
Would
interest.
Pull that microphone a little bit closer and talk into it.
Okay. Is that better?
That's better.
I have a special interest in mechanical and musical antiques. My reason for being here is to support House Bill 2652, which will allow Oregon residents to legally own and display antique gambling devices. As this measure does not allow the machines to be used for gambling, I can see no harm in its passage. As you know, California passed legislation last year allowing California residents ownership of antique gambling machines, resulting in many machines once used in Oregon finding their way to new owners in California. Several other states are considering similar legislation this year, including Texas, Washington, Idaho, Colorado, New York, New Jersey, and Florida. Law enforcement agencies that I've contacted include Douglas County Sheriff's Department, Coos County District Attorney's Office, and the Eastside Police Department. All of them have shown support for this bill. I have photos of some of my collections and of several reprint catalogs if you'd like to see them. Any questions you may have, I'll try to answer. Thank you.
Have they asked you to destroy these devices yet, or have they taken any action against you as far as these, or are they threatened to, or what?
No. For years now, the police department normally aren't interested in prosecuting people that collect that sort of machine. The Oregon law was pretty fuzzy up until this year when we tried with 2652. The sheriff of Douglas County asked for a definition of gambling device, slot machines and such, which was included in House Bill 2341, which is passed the Senate here now, House and Senate. So the definitions are in the first bill. And to answer the question about the 1941 date, that date is being used by other states, and I think it would keep everything pretty much on an even keel if the legislation of various states was very similar. Some machines would be in a gray area then, possibly.
Okay. Any questions? If not, have you got the language worked out?
Yes, Senator, we have.
Okay. You want to read it?
Can I go down there?
Senator Jernstedt hasn't had his question answered yet.
Yeah, he answered it.
Well, there'd be a few machines in the gray area, possibly, but They wanted to bring it in accord with all the other legislation that has been passed by the other states, and they all say 41.
Okay. Senator, I would propose that, along with Senator Carson, that Section 3 would now read, it is a defense to a charge of possession of a gambling device if the slot machine or gambling device which caused the charge to be brought was manufactured prior to 1941 and was not operated for purposes of unlawful gambling. And I think that takes care of all the concerns that everyone had.
Okay. Do you want to make the motion?
I'll make that motion.
Senator Carson moves the amendments be adopted. Are there any objections?
Mr. Chairman, explanation of what we've done, and I want to check with the person that's the most interested in this bill. We got into trouble defining antique, triggering the thing on antique, and then defining antique. If we really are going just to pick an arbitrary date, and I realize it's not totally arbitrary, but we're just going to say 1942 or 1941, why don't we just thrust of this just to say it right up and not create the category of antique? We just say everything before 1941. As long as you're not gambling with it, the possession of it before 1941 is not violent, is a defense, I should say, and that's what we had. Have we done any violence on?
No, okay. I don't see any harm.
We've taken some of the art out of it, but I think it reads a little better. So.
Can't disagree with it.
There were no objections to the amendment, so they are so ordered. Senator Carson now moves that we pass House Bill 2652, as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Clerk, we'll call the roll.
Senator Carson?
Aye.
Senator Jernstad?
Aye.
Senator Roberts?
Aye.
Senator Cho?
Aye.
Senator Wire?
Will this cause any trouble?
Do you want to vote on this bill? 2652.
Good
bill. Mr. Chairman?
Aye.
Sorry, I wasn't here when you got it, but I'm in another hearing. So I'll have to go back.
Is anyone here on the 9-foot sheet?
Nancy, Representative Tate is here tonight.
Okay. House Bill 2446 is an earth-shaking bill, and we have a lovely witness here.
What's your
2446? I don't have it.
Well, it's he's represented by a constituent.
Yeah.
Give your name, please.
Mr. Chairman and members of the Senate Labor, Business, and Consumer Affairs Committee, I'm Ruth Vermoser, and I'm representing Nancy Fadley, who is tied up on the House floor with a debate on steel burning, and she cannot attend to the lecture.
My mind just took off on that one.
So what I would like to say in representing Nancy's opinion is that she is urging passage of this bill and a repeal of the statute for two reasons. One, the statute is not being enforced now, which you have before you. Secondly, there's no evident reason why the original bill, Senate Bill 18, introduced January 12, 1909, was being introduced. Legislative Council has researched this, but we can find no reason for the statute or the original bill. The only possible clue to this is in a biographic sketch of its sponsor, Senator Kelleher, who has many occupations, one of them being with the laundry business, so there might be a clue there.
Was he 8 feet tall also?
I don't know.
That's what I thought she was going to say.
You know
him. Nancy believes that the non-enforcement of the statute could take some rather unique turns. For example, a law student could stay in a hotel or a motel and claim that he can avoid paying a bill because the bed sheets were not 9 feet long. So she is urging a repeal of the statute and passage of the bill.
I'm sorry I didn't know about this statute sooner.
Yeah.
You're right.
You should have a copy of that before you.
Okay. Is there any questions about this? If not, I'd entertain a motion to Pass it out.
I'll move it to 402-5.
Senator Trobo's Senate Bill 2446 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. The clerk will call the roll.
Senator Carson?
It was your testimony that...
Senator Carson?
Oh, boy. One of the more significant things I've done this session, I'll vote aye.
Senator Grinstead?
Aye.
Senator Roberts?
Aye.
Senator Tro?
Aye.
Senator Wire?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye.
I hope nobody tells
that's
John
a very,
about
very that difficult bill to carry. I think I'm.
I wouldn't touch it with a.
Carson, you think you can handle that?
Service.
I will.
I have not refused you, but that turkey is going to fly on its own wings.
Well, I know it's controversial. Mary will carry it because
it'll make the law better.
That's right.
I look forward to short sheeting you on this, Senator.
Oh,
it might be a woman's skin.
Call it an anachronism. And it'll...
Okay, let's get
this. No reason we answered. This was a mistake from the.
Oh, yeah. We're going to hear 3017 and 2177 at the same time. We left off the hearing, and not everyone. Did you? You didn't have a chance. Yeah, you did testify on that. Dick, you testified on this bill once before, did you not?
I saw that there wasn't anybody to stand up.
Well, I think as long as you've testified, why, if there are any questions that the that committee members have, why, we will be asking you. Or I might say that we've met with the insurance carriers, these that carry hospital or medical coverage, and were opposed, strongly opposed to using or setting aside a reserve, and the suggestion was 0.25% of the year for 4 years. And I feel that it would cause the bill, or it really caused some problems as far as the bill is concerned.
There are a couple of things that are, like, to say right briefly that I don't think were called to the attention of the committee last time by myself or anyone else. I know that great hope that the fund will be adequate, and we all hope that. But a couple of things that you should take into consideration is, number one, being presented at bargain rate, the Oregon Medical Association is rising its own rate, and they are substantially less than what they could gain comparable coverage.
Could he talk in the microphone?
Yeah, we want to talk to in the microphone there.
Before he goes on, could I get up to date on where we are, Mr. Chairman? The now, last time there was some proposal made that the bill be changed to allow. Didn't the
it was a suggestion of the insurance commissioner that they impose a tax on the insurance carriers that write this type of coverage of 1%. And they felt that this would give the companies enough reserve if they did, the fund, the secondary fund that's going to be administered by the insurance commissioner, enough, what he felt was an adequate reserve, might say that we had a meeting with those involved, those representatives of the doctors, as well as the carriers, are very reluctant to go this route. Now, if there the provision was and the suggestion was that if there was no need to draw that money, if the fund was adequate as far as the contributions by the doctors was adequate to cover all losses, then this fund wouldn't be tapped. This fund would be set aside by the insurance carrier. They would have custody of it. They could invest it. But they'd have to set aside 0.25% of all premiums, a quarter percent tax on all premiums. We got nowhere on it. So we're back where we are. We've got the bill before us as it is.
You say we, you mean
the committee.
You and me.
Committee is.
No, but I mean, when you met with, somebody met with the...
they had a meeting of their own. I set up a meeting with them, and this was the result of this meeting.
They didn't like that idea of the insurance commission.
No.
Okay, I think I'm up to date, thank you.
But that doesn't make it binding on the committee, and you're feel free to do what you please.
The things that I wanted to point out were just that the way it's written, it is a bargain for the Oregon Medical Association. They're getting more coverage for a lot less money than they could get it commercially.
And is that bad?
No, that's great, but I think you should take that into consideration in trying to decide whether the fund's going to be adequate or not.
Well, let me say this. As I understand the bill, correct me if I'm wrong, and I'm sure I'm not, that say that you get one of your usual judgments for one of your clients, $5-6 million, and the fund is not adequate, they can pay, say, pay them half of it. They got only $4 million, so they give you $4 million that year, and they'll pay it off so much the next year, and as a fund, and then there's nothing to prohibit them from increasing that fund, assessing the doctors to a greater extent. So that fund is, but I know the attorney, I know attorneys want all their money at once.
Well, no, that would be, you know, people are willing to wait for their money. What's one of the suggestions is an annuity, and the people, I don't think that you would run into opposition on that, Senator, but the problem is that if the fund is exhausted by one big claim or a number of claims, then you've got to hope that next year the doctors are going to sign up on this, and it's strictly a voluntary program. And what you're saying is that the insurance commissioner could increase the assessment to make up the deficit. But as soon as he jacks up the assessment and the doctor can find a better deal someplace else, he's not going to go for it. And so there's not going to be any money in the fund next year. You can't count on something taking place next year.
Are you saying then that you'd like to jack up the assessment now so the fund would be adequate?
Either jack up the assessment. There are several ways that you could do it. You could jack up the assessment to the individual doctors. I'm sure that they will oppose that. Secondly, you could back it up with the possible tax on the health insurance carriers. We proposed 1%. That's what the task force recommendation was. It would only be implemented if the fund ran dry. The third thing that you could do is if you made it mandatory, then you know you'd have substantial participation. You don't know whether you're going to have one doctor, 10 doctors, 100, or 1,000 doctors sign up on this thing. You don't know whether you're going to have $1,000 or $1 million in the fund. You've got no idea.
We've had an indication from the doctors, in fact, that there will be a substantial number there enthused about the program, the ones I have talked to.
You know, they were enthused about the program that came through the legislature last session, and only one doctor signed up.
They were advised by their counsel. Now, that's a different situation. I'm sure you're aware of it. They were advised by their counsel that it might not even be constitutional. They didn't want to put their money unless they knew it was lawful to do so.
That's correct.
No problem.
That's correct, Senator. But this, you know, these doctors throughout the state have individual lawyers, and they're going to receive similar advice this session, I think. I mean, maybe a lot will sign up. Maybe half of them will sign up. Kaiser was here 2 weeks ago and said maybe they will and maybe they won't. That's 200 doctors. But what it boils down to is if there isn't enough money in the fund, then the most seriously injured patient doesn't get his compensation. And I think that the decision that you have to face is it better for the loss to fall on him, or the person who caused the wrong, or the health insurance industry.
I want to know why that would happen, because my impression is that any claim the court judged would be payable, right?
No, because the doctor is immune by the terms of the statute. The patient can collect his money only from the doctor's insurance policy or from the excess liability fund. He cannot ask the doctor to pay it personally. The doctor has
only those doctors immune who take part in the system?
Correct, sir.
But they are immune.
That's right.
He can only pay what he has in insurance.
Well, he would have, each doctor that participated would carry $100,000 worth of insurance. So there would be $100,000 for the patient. The patient, if he had a judgment in excess of the $100,000, could then look only to the excess liability fund to satisfy that judgment. If there's money there, he'll get paid. If there isn't money there,
does he have a continuing claim on that fund until he does get paid?
Yes. Yeah. It doesn't so state, but it could be interpreted that way. That's correct. But the problem with that, Senator, is you don't know whether more money is going to come in the next year or not. It's just, you know, there is no assurance of solvency. And the problem is that if the fund has a very bad experience this year, and the legislature next session says, okay, we got to get more money into that fund, and say that you would double the assessment, the doctors are free to say, I don't want to pay it this year. I can get my insurance from St. Paul or CNA for less, and so that leaves that claimant unpaid. That's the problem that's created, and that's why the task force recommended the backstop.
Of course, by the same token, CNA and the carrier may be canceling them out, and they have nothing regardless. Except
that,
maybe primary.
That was,
this is happening.
The trend is going back the other way, I think. There was a legitimate fear a couple of years ago, but I think we're over that, huh?
Didn't the insurance commissioner testify at the last hearing that there wasn't any crisis in insurance as of today in Oregon?
I have my recollection, but it may be suspect. I know we heard an awful lot on this subject in the task force, and I know that CNA did not increase premiums this time on the basic underlying coverage, and I think that the worst part of the problem is behind us. I might say, gentlemen, that no state in the country has ever adopted a limit as low as $100,000, which I gather is what you're about to do. It will be,
we're not adopting. This is not a limit of $100,000.
It's a limit of $100,000, and the Russian roulette is getting something more.
On the primary insurance, and there'll be about $4 million a year contributed to that fund, in the secondary fund, which is available.
Well, the testimony last session was that there's going to be $2 or $3 million in the fund by now, and there's only 150. So you don't know.
There is 150.
Yeah, one doctor signed up and paid $150 in the last 2 years.
What was this that you said about the doctor's lawyer said this might be what? Or was that you that said that?
The Oregon Medical Association, last after they got what they wanted out of the last session of the legislature, advised the doctors not to participate in it because they were concerned that it might be unconstitutional. And so that has a lot to do, I'm sure, with only one doctor participating in the whole state. I understand that the Oregon Medical Association is going to advise the doctors to participate if this bill is passed. I don't think that you can therefore assume that every doctor in the state is going to follow that recommendation, because he's still going to have concern. If it is held unconstitutional, and there'll have to be a court test, then the doctor would remain personally liable if it were held unconstitutional.
The doctor would have to seek other coverage then.
If he had to carry another policy, why would he participate in the excess fund? If you were in that situation,
if he can find it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And practically, there's some of them that are writing less than what you could find in their secondary fund. They're only writing $100,000, $300,000, $100,000 for first, and $300,000 for a year.
Well, so St. Paul offers a million.
It seems to me that you're better off as lawyers in getting your fees, and I know you must be interested in those. That if you had this fund, this secondary fund set up there, if the question should arise that all they can get is $100,000, $300,000, and they can't get excess through a private carrier.
Forget about it.
And you might say it's getting better. We have no assurance. Certainly, the insurance market is not getting better as far as other coverages are concerned, and I see no reason why it should get better in this field. But if
well,
it does
forget
get
about
better,
the lawyer. I'm not.
If it does get better, it's, as you say it is, it seems to me they'd have the fund would increase here as the doctors contribute. Also, there'd be a greater amount of money in there for the benefit of the lawyers and the patients.
If, Senator Groner, if it was apparent that this fund was going to be sufficient, then the health insurance industry would never be asked to pay a dime under the proposal of the insurance commissioner. And yet they've come in here and lobbied the daylights out of every senator and opposed it as vigorously as they can. The only conclusion, reasonable conclusion, is opposed insurance tax backstop to the excess liability fund.
The doctors haven't lobbied against that.
I'm saying the insurance, you just told us
that the insurance industry has.
If this fund were going to be solvent and the insurance industry would never have to pay a dime, why do you suppose they oppose it so vigorously?
Well, this has nothing to do with malpractice of companies that would be assessed, as you know.
They wouldn't have to pay anything unless the fund ran dry under the insurance commissioner's proposal. But they don't want to be in that position because they're fearful that they're going to have to pay. And I hate to see the patients in that position, because if the fund runs dry, then they don't get paid. And you saw some of these people and how devastated they can be by medical incompetence. We don't like it, but it's true. It happens.
You know, I don't think I know one of the doctors who was involved there, and he handled my children when they were little. And I think, as you as a lawyer, I don't know if you've ever made a mistake, but I think
I do know
some lawyers have made a mistake. And this doctor feels very badly about it, the one, this little girl that you showed. And he's one of the finest pediatricians in the state of Oregon. And he made a mistake, and he paid for it and was willing to pay for it. And
we are talking about criminal penalties here. I don't think we're talking about
it was recompensing. It was a mistake.
Recompensing with money.
So, but to say this doctor is not a good, excellent doctor. He's one of the finest pediatricians in the state, and I think you'd agree.
I didn't say that he was. All I'm asking is the people to get hurt. The fact that he's a good doctor doesn't bring that little girl's brains back.
Yeah.
And the fact that the doctor here in Salem paralyzed that other gentleman, you see, and that he may or may not be a good doctor doesn't help him at all.
He's a good doctor. I don't disagree with your point,
but likewise. All we're seeking is money compensation for these people.
Senator Drove?
Mr. Chairman, I think what the witness is saying in terms of the importance of having adequate funds in the special fund that we're creating, I think that's important. And, you know, if very few doctors do subscribe and do put money into it, then I think we have done the patients a disservice if they can only collect the 100,000 plus whatever is in the fund. I'm wondering, have we considered, or did the House consider the possibility of saying that the fund will be effective and this act will be effective when, let's say, 80% of the eligible doctors participate or something like that? Have we done that?
That might be an angle. What I'd like to do, I think, unless you have something further to add, I'm going to ask...
I have one question.
Okay.
Dick, how does the settlement thing work? I've been trying to wrestle through. Let's suppose we're above the insurance. How do you see that working? We want to settle. The physician wants to settle. The claimant wants to settle for $225,000. What's the machinery for that?
The settlement, you would petition a court. It's the way that the law is now written, and I think that's carried over in the new bill, where you would file a petition in any circuit court in the state, and you would go in and say that this is the injury, this is the liability, this amount we believe would be reasonable, and seek court approval.
Okay. And that approval then binds the fund?
Yes. The fund has an opportunity to appear and oppose. Yes, the fund is notified in advance. And you see, there's one other thing. I forgot to bring it up last time, I almost forgot this time. Another reason why this fund may not be adequate is under this bill, the fund must pay costs of defense. And the testimony, which we had before the task force, varied. The cost of defense eats up 25 to 40% of the premium dollar. And so that money on the claim that exceeds $100,000 is taken out of the excess fund, the defense cost.
We have to have an amendment here to limit attorney fees. No.
Are there any further questions? If not, I would ask Dr. Llewellyn and Dr. Crawford and any of those that are interested if they'd sit up here and
can I ask, while Dr. Llewellyn is settling in, the tripartite hearing, and I found it finally, maybe Tom can help me on it, Section 4, you reach a $225,000 settlement. Do we have any problem? Would I have to try my case before the court on this petition that goes to the insurance commissioner, I think, or that's what it used to be? And how does that work?
No, all you have to do is get court approval if the insurance commissioner agrees to the settlement. He's the guardian of the money in the fund.
Mm-hmm.
And if he agrees to it, you merely get court approval, as you do now, for instance, in minor settlement records, what is contemplated.
Well, yeah, but that's a little different, though.
For the record, this is Tom Cooney, counsel for the Oregon Medical Association.
Thank you. I'm sorry. The court, what I'm trying to get is who's bargaining for the fund. You just, I think, just said the insurance commissioner. The court's not bargaining for the fund, because in the minor situation, the court is really bargaining for the child or the minor. Yes. In this case, we look at the insurance commissioner, and if he says that's a fair settlement, based on whatever proof he needs to agree that it's a fair settlement, then we've got a bargain.
It's contemplated that he would be a party to the defense plaintiff negotiations if the negotiations involve sums greater than the underlying insurance policy. He would be notified of it and would be able to contact the parties and review the files and make whatever independent judgment he wishes so that the insurance company or that lawyer or the plaintiff's lawyer have unlimited access to the fund which is set aside for the victim.
And you probably just said it, Tom, and I wandered. The insurance commissioners, let's say the carrier, the doctor, the physician, the claimant, all say $225 is fair. The insurance commissioner says, no, it should be $175. What happens then?
Then I think the court could approve a settlement in excess
of what the insurance commissioner
says and have that paid.
Would you presume that he would take evidence on physicians on extent and degree of injury?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman,
I'd like to ask a question first. You heard the concern of Senator Trow that there may not be enough doctors participating in this program, and we did hear from Kaiser, which I thought their testimony was very weak, that they may and they may not participate. What would you think of the proposal? I thought that Senator Trow's proposal may strengthen the bill in that if 80 or 90% of the doctors participate, if you have the secondary coverage, if they fail to, then if they probably wouldn't be adequately financed, and therefore perhaps it's a no-go.
Well, I want to just address that question, Mr. Chairman. I think our first choice, unquestionably, would not be to have that provision in. I wanted to refer back to what Mr. Noble said. He began by saying that this bill is offering the physician such a good deal, and then he turns around and says, it's such a good deal, the physicians won't go into the fund, which is a contradiction. It will be to the advantage of the physician to go into the fund because indeed he will, about two-thirds of the physicians will save some money, and in addition they will buy unlimited liability protection. So we feel they will go into the fund, and the Oregon Medical Association does have an impact on its membership, and a good example is that only one physician went into the fund when we told him not to go into the fund. And he went in, he was Dr. Payne, who was president at the time, he went in because we requested him to do so that we could use his name in court. There wasn't one physician in the state who went in when we said, we recommend not going in. We are saying to the physicians of this state, members of the Oregon Medical Association, yes, indeed, it is a good program. We feel that it takes care of any constitutional concerns that we have, and we are going to be selling the program to have physicians go into the state because we think it is the best thing for the physicians.
There were two or three questions that Mr. Noble raised that I'd like to address also. That, again, the settlement or the judgment that he's talking about, the $5 million case, there has not been a settlement or a judgment against a physician in this state for more than $500,000. The examples that have been raised are 10 times more than any judgment or settlement in this state in the history. Since 1971, under CNA and St. Paul that insure the physicians, there have only been 17 settlements or judgments over $100,000. So we're looking at, if all physicians go in, $4 million or in excess of $4 million per year, which probably would not be touched for the first 2 years, so we'd probably have a sum of somewhere, I don't know, $6 to $8 million, assuming not all physicians go in. We think we have a viable fund. And let's say that he is right, you know, that a settlement or a judgment does indeed come in for $5 million, which would be 10 times the amount that's ever been awarded in this state. The insurance commissioner under this bill with court approval could say, I'm only going to pay a percentage of that, 10% or what have you, let's say $500,000. For that year, he could come back to the legislature and say, I have pending a $4.5 million settlement. There's not enough money in the excess fund. It's time to come up with additional funds. We don't think that's going to happen, but if that catastrophe did have happened, he would have an opportunity to deal with it.
Could I interrupt at that point, Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead.
Okay, let's run it on out. The fund's $4.5 million short. This is voluntary. There's no statutory requirement that any position belong. Let's suppose the assessment, as Mr. Noble's indicated, it didn't look like what they're saying is that the fund is bankrupt. What ties the physician in? Certainly the court or the legislature can't order physicians to belong, I mean, unless we make it mandatory to practice and put it in with their practice. What's to keep the physicians from saying, hey, that's not a good deal. I'm dropping out of this neat system because although it was good in 77, the assessment now is three times what it was.
There is no requirement that they stay in.
Right.
And the thing that you talk about could happen. They could go somewhere else if there was a market for it. CNA, who heretofore offered a $5 million policy, has informed us as of May 1, it'll be $1 million. Now, I am sensitive to fixed concern over collecting every penny of every judgment. But life isn't that way. And there is no constitutional guarantee that you're going to be injured by a unlimitedly solvent individual. And if he does get a $5 million verdict next June 1st for an event that happened after May 1st, and there's only $1 million insurance because that's all that's written in the state, and the doctor's personal assets are only $100,000, he's still going to be a million or two or three or four short.
Well, I thought this was a sole remedy kind of thing. As a legislator, I thought I'd have a real severe burden if I lifted the responsibility of, plus you said, you know, they were a poor physician or a very wealthy one, lifted the responsibility off him and transferred on the state and then said, sorry, the program's bankrupt. Isn't that the way it worked?
Yes. Yes.
You don't see any problem with that. You don't, that's just... Well, no, not constitutionally, but from a moral standpoint. You don't see any problem with me letting that physician have whatever assets he wants, and I have legislatively put in a limit. You don't see any moral problem with that? You liken that as just say, well, that's the way the brakes go. You got run in by a doctor, not only who didn't have enough money, but a doctor who's very wealthy, but had friends in the legislature that wrote a neat program that protects him.
No, I just don't think that you can constitutionally guarantee...
Oh, yeah.
That which isn't available now in life. I could bring down as many clients that I've defended in automobile accident cases and wheelchairs.
I'm an expert in that. I hear you. You're right on. I agree with that.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's the exact case today. In Oregon, there are many physicians who carry $100,000 worth of insurance. If somebody slapped them with a $5 million judgment or settlement, they'd get $100,000 under the existing system. They don't garnish the wages.
Yeah. That's all they can get. The thing that we've tried to do with the fund is
reasonably based upon the figures and the background and experience, jack it up to the point where we think it's secure. Now, sure, someday, somehow, it might go broke. The interesting thing is that most of the time in these big verdict cases, you've all been privy to the negotiations that have gone on and back, and I won't disclose any of them, but many times the figures that are kicked around as far as settlement is concerned are far less than what the verdict ultimately comes out to be, and the final judgment is far less than the ultimate settlement. So you might get $1 million verdict that is settled for $750,000. And, you know, $4 or $5 million per year on top of $100,000 for each doctor, when you have never had claims in any one year that exceeded $100,000 go more than $500,000 in any one year.
Chairman?
Quite a bit.
Senator Carson? Well, Tom, that's what I'm fighting on that is that the whole business of us even talking about this and bringing the physician problem is the fear of what could happen as a result of what's happened in other states. I felt this way in 75. If I were looking at the track record of what happened in Oregon, I don't think we have the problem that other states have had. Now, I may be in error, but I would agree. First of all, I think we have a good group of physicians. I think we have not had the problem. So, but the fact is we're here. I mean, that augurs for dropping the whole thing and letting doctors just do the same thing as everybody else does rather than trying to cut a special program. The whole idea of cutting a special program is this fear of the outrageous rates or premiums they're paying, plus the fact we may be driving doctors out of the business.
This is the argument that we have made. Why Oregon? Why do we have to pay so much? We haven't been that bad.
Well, you know what the lawyers did, which we're coming the same way, we went into our own fund. We didn't, you know, we came to the legislature to get authority to go to our own fund because we're getting caught in the same
thing. Bear in mind, that policy is only going to be $100,000, and there's no backup fund. So if you get tagged $1 million through the lawyer's malpractice, the only fund you're going to have.
But there's no immunity either.
No,
well, after they exhaust the $100,000, they can come and take the shirt right off my back.
Right.
Which is not the problem the program we're talking about here.
But in the long run, you may be better off financially to go, instead of your shirt, which may not have great value, to have a fund which is substituted for it. And this
not a fund that I can get in and out of, though. That's, I think, critical. Okay.
It's been suggested by Senator Trow that perhaps you could give us a guarantee of 80-90% of the doctors who would participate in this program so we could have some assurance that there would be funds there. And any time that fell below 80 or 90% a membership in this fund, I'm just saying somewhere between there, that the fund would be no longer, it would be inoperative. In other words, it would depend on you. And I can't see where, as long as we've had assurances from you, John, that the medical society is going to, if you say no, you only had one member participate, and that was for a trial case, and that was Dr. Payne from Milwaukee, that if you say go with this program, you kind of assured this committee that you'd have 90, perhaps 100% participation. So what if we'd set an amount there?
I see problems in trying to implement it, and from a practical standpoint, the day that this physician, who presently is carrying $1 million coverage, gives up that coverage and takes out a policy of 100, 300 thou, he becomes vulnerable unless the fund is there to back him up. So the problem would be trying to find that day where everybody would agree to go into the fund. Everybody would
like you're going to have trouble in the first place. You're admitting to me then that you're going to have trouble.
No,
in the first
place. Do you understand my problem? If I all of a sudden give up my mill to go to 100, 300 thou, I want to be assured that fund, and I put my 500 to 3 thou into the fund, I've got to be assured that I'm going to be protected. And the only way I can be protected is to know that fund is operable.
Okay, how's he going to know it the first year or even the second year?
Because that's the way the law is. He will pay into the fund, and then everybody will go in and be comfortable with the fund, and we will sell it on that basis.
Okay.
But if they're waiting for the 70 to 80%, they're going to be sitting vulnerable.
When you give the word, Well, when you give the word, you already told us that.
On day one, everybody goes in.
Charge full of speed ahead.
I don't think it would work from a practical standpoint on that basis.
The LMA has spoken.
Give them a little note. Do you think
the lawyers, if you said day one, everybody ponies up the money, otherwise you're going to be vulnerable? A fund like this would be implemented. I don't think any professor. There is no question in my mind. As a professional organization, we have lots of influence on our group. But I would hate to say that we would have to get 80% of the doctors in this state on one day to go into the fund.
I never said one day, but you know.
That's what you would be requiring, because for the physician to give up his insurance, he would have to know that that fund indeed is backing him up, or it couldn't be implemented.
I think what we'd like to know is that we're going to have participation. Here you have, what's this small group that has a little hospital east of Milwaukee and one up in North Portland? Kaiser.
Wilhelm Kaiser.
They came here and they testified we're for the program. Are you going to participate? Well, I don't know if we will participate or not, you know. But they really showed enthusiasm, and that's it.
Senator, may I offer an explanation to the Kaiser program? Because they are a singular group, just a large partnership, they are in a self-insured situation, which they are have about a $50,000 or $100,000 deductible, which they take care of themselves in-house. A large group of the independent doctors cannot do that. The reason that Kaiser doesn't think they would convert from what they're doing now into this program is to qualify as a self-insurance program to meet the insurance commissioner's needs. They would have to have a much larger set of funds available in their self-insurance, so it's going to be cheaper for them to stay that way, and so they probably wouldn't. Your private physicians, the idea of the 80% is an administrative nightmare for two reasons. Number one, your physicians in the state are on staggered monthly premiums. Not all doctors pay at the same time. So they would be, for a 12-month period, their renewal dates are in existence, and if you started collecting $3,000 from your class sixes, you wouldn't have the program effective at that time, and yet they'd be carrying, in order to be protected, they have to be carrying double coverage. The other thing is, if it once drops 79%, then you have lap coverage with no protection, and it's akin to what you get into when a doctor converts from a claims made to an occurrence policy. It's a nightmare.
Senator Drope, I wanted to ask either of you gentlemen, John, probably, how do you anticipate the doctors coming into this program? Will they come in gradually over a year's time? Is that what you're saying? When it's convenient for them because of other insurance dropping or whatever, so that there won't be an initial amount of money we can expect into this fund all at once if we put it into effect. And what about, if that's the case, what about the possible claimants on that fund in case the fund is not adequate while it's a building?
I think the answer to your question, and it's unfortunate we don't have them here, but Commissioner Rawls, when the 1975 bill was enacted, set down some rules and regulations at hearings, and it's my memory that one of those was that the payment for participation in the fund had to be made on a certain annual anniversary date around between January 1st and January 5th. Only people then that could come in at a later time would be those coming in later in practice or just joining practice. So there is, under the rules and regulations, a specified time. In talking to CNA, what I have anticipated is that they would, in effect, terminate as of a given date all of their $1 million policies and write only the $100,000 premium or policy. They have indicated, not formally but informally in discussions with me, is that if the legislator passed this law and the doctors opted to go into it, then they would no longer offer the $1 million policy. They would write just the one policy. I have told the doctors that if this bill in this form came out, it would be my recommendation
was legally sufficient and legally sound, and therefore I would recommend they go into it. I do not support that.
Let's say we pass the bill, we do it as you'd like to have it done. How quickly can we expect that we'll have a majority of the doctors in the fund?
My guess would be the fall, by January.
By fall. If we've made it operative, when?
July 1? January 1st.
January 1st. By fall, we would have majority of the doctors in. We would begin to be building the fund.
Well, no. I think what would happen is that the decision would be made to go. CNA Insurance Company would say to the doctors, they are now going to only write a 100-300 policy effective January 1. You are now entitled to contribute to the fund and buy this extra coverage. It's going to be cheaper than buying what they're now buying if they buy $1 million coverage. There's going to be a financial incentive. There probably won't be any place else to buy it.
Now, what about the doctor's liability? If the doctor chooses to give up that $1 million policy and chooses not to come into this fund, what happens to his liability in case he commits malpractice?
Same as he is now.
Same as now. He's personally liable for whatever the charge is brought against him. So it would be to his advantage to get into this fund.
Absolutely.
Yeah. There's no way he can benefit from the fund being in existence if he's not in it.
That's right.
Okay.
Just as he is now.
This would give us a year. He'd be in effect a year, essentially.
Yes.
That would give us till the next 1979 session. And if it wasn't working, we could...
I think Tom feels that, and perhaps he can state more about this, that there will be no claims against the fund in the next 2 years that would be settled in any way, so that the fund would be intact while the next legislature is meeting in 79 to review the activity.
It usually takes a year to 18 months before you have a claim that surfaces that is basically sufficient enough to have some idea what it's going to cost or what it's worth. We saw it when the Hawaiian Insurance Company came in and took over after Oregon Auto. It was about a year to 18 months before you saw your claim. We saw it when CNA came in. There's a lag period. The negligent act may occur, but it might be a year and a half before there's an active claim presented. There can be claims earlier, but the likelihood of any claim that's going to exceed $100,000 surfacing with that certainty that soon is rare.
June.
Senator Robert?
Can you how confident are you that you can make that statement when you don't know if there are people out there that are, for example, right at this very moment discovering that they might have a legitimate claim?
All right. Because
somewhere in the state of Oregon.
Right. Because the people that have a claim now that have been negligently injured, their claim has vested and it isn't subject to payment by this fund that will come into existence at a later date. It will only be prospective.
Okay. It won't be implemented until this. The only people who would be covered, the people who have a claim after this bill, if it does indeed pass, would be passed. Everybody else would be still operating under the old system.
Okay, so an individual who discovers that they have that, if they wait on making a claim until this bill goes into effect, they will be covered, though.
They would be, if a person in the OMA program, the OMA CNA program, had a claim he knew of today, yet he, for whatever reason, chose not to assert it until a year from now when this program was active, he would be treated under the existing law now, insofar as the way it's claimed.
So what if that individual had a claim that exceeded that? That was a very high.
Let's say he had a $5 million verdict. It would go against his existing now today
insurance policy. If he happened to have a $5 million policy, he would get paid the $5 million. If the doctor had a $100,000 policy, like some now have, he would get that, and then whatever personal assets he could find, which were not immune, and if the doctor chose to do it to bankruptcy, he might get 10 cents of the dollar.
No, I guess we're not communicating.
Okay. What I'm saying is the negligent act that occurs today would, in, under the OMA CNA program, would not be affected in any way by the creation of this plan going into effect.
I know that. Not what I'm talking about.
I'm sorry. Okay.
Let's say the negligent act has a, you know, maybe I'm just being hearing it correctly. What if the negligent act has already occurred that has not been discovered or a claim filed? And the person waits to file the claim until this law becomes effective. For some reason, maybe they're just taking some time to think about it and consult with members of the family, and they want to go through this, and they go to retaining, and then the claim is filed. My understanding of what you had just said was that you have no knowledge of, you know, could you foresee this fund being tapped for 2 years? And I just didn't know if in a case like that I just alluded to, the hypothetical, you know, the hypothetical could exist, could it not?
Well.
And that would, I don't see how you could say that there aren't such cases that would come up.
The answer that I gave was, in fact, response. I understood your question. I'm not making myself clear. If that doctor were in the present OMA CNA program, and he negligently injured the patient today, and the claim was made sometime later, the existence of this bill would have no bearing on that claim. That patient's rights and the insurance that was involved took place and vested on that day, and he would make his claim.
Okay, so it would be from the date of the alleged Malpractice Act as opposed to the date of coverage.
Right.
Okay.
Now, I don't want to mislead you, because there are, in the St. Paul group of doctors, which is a small portion, they are what we call a claims made policy. And those could fall into it. There's about one-third the number of doctors in that.
Well, let me summarize what way I feel now. If I sense a committee right, they feel that there should be some guarantee, whether it's assessing the insurance company a 0.25% a year, or whether we guarantee a certain percentage of the doctors. If you want to pull a committee, or the committee wants to make a motion on this bill to find out the sentiment of the committee, I'm willing to accept it. But this is what I sense at this time, that there should be some guarantee, some backing there. That if you do have a claim, that you're not going to have the doctors failing to subscribe to this secondary fund.
Mr. Chairman,
I think they've
eased my feelings somewhat by the fact that they're saying that if the fund is not adequate, that the insurance commissioner will come and say that there should be claims on the fund.
Yes, if there's any money in the fund.
Yeah, if there's any money in the fund. So I guess what we've got to make sure is that fund is a viable fund and the doctors subscribe to it. And how are we going to make sure that's going to happen and can keep happening?
And we'll continue to subscribe to it.
After this will be good.
Senator Carson?
I was just going to say, one of the things that concerned me, and it was in existence 2 years ago, and it's still there, that while everyone is trying to do right, let me paint a scenario that, let's suppose, and then I think the people that were here trying to help, and that's the physicians today, and their patients, would be the ones who really wind up hurting, and that would be the situation where not everybody gets in, there is a large claim, or several $1 million claims, or several $100,000 claims, so the request is made beyond the availability of funds in the excess fund category.
the alternative suggested is that we can assess the members. Let's assume they drop out rather than being assessed. Then the fund collapses. The legislature then is presented with a problem. What do we do then? And we can add it, as somebody has suggested, adding it on to health care costs. And I think, John, you were right in worrying about what happens when the physician leaves his own insurance company and jumps into the pond. What if the pond dries up and the legislature undoes it? Then he's going to have to leap back into the commercial world. Is that a concern, or am I just cutting this out of whole cloth? I think that's what I'm saying is I worry about our bar thing on that. Yeah. I worry about us saying, to heck with the insurance companies, we're going to do it on ourselves, and then it doesn't work out. And in the meantime, CNA or St. Paul has said, we didn't like this business anyway.
No, I don't think that there is anything to compel or bind the physician and lock them in. They could, if they could find other insurance.
Or go bare.
Or go bare. And if they go bare, then
they're in trouble.
You're going to have, they're going to be in trouble, and you're going to have people that are hurt without any money.
I understand. I'm not recommending that. Yeah.
So my only thought is this. Les Rawls is chairman of the National Insurance Commissioners. He says on the horizon, it doesn't look like it's going to get any better. There are six companies that are riding it nationally now. It's my view that, like CNA, they say, okay, you used to have $5 million, now you only get $1 million because they've lost their reinsurance market. There's probably not going to be any place to go, because I think what we're coming to, you've seen the same thing in product liability. Nobody is going to insure this type of thing anymore, and you're eventually, even though I may have personal views that are not shared in that regard, we may convert drastically our method of compensation in tort awards, and therefore you may not any longer be finding $5 million.
What you're trying to tell this committee is, in an absence of a market for insurance, this is second best.
Yeah. And the thing is we've got to do something now to start cutting costs. And this is one way to do it.
Well, you say...
Go ahead.
You say we aren't going to have $5 million. And then when we say, well, it might be a big award and wipe the thing out, and we say, well, $500,000 is the most we're bet now. You mean we may not have any more $500,000 awards in Oregon? Or $5 million? We haven't had a $5 million award in Oregon.
No. $500,000 is the greatest.
$500,000.
Well, Dick got $1.3 million against the hospital. Hospitals aren't governed by that.
Okay, so it's what the subject we're talking about now, $500,000.
The largest one is $500,000+.
Are you making an argument that I think you kind of got off the point there quite a ways, but I don't want to compound it by going out even farther.
There has been a lot of emphasis on the negative. The positive side of it is that, number one, we think the physicians indeed will go into the fund. We think that they will be able to save money and that we'll provide them protection.
Jim, what would be wrong with a guarantee you're going to have so many physicians by January 19?
My problem with that is what has been talked about before, that if it's 70% or 60%, that every time, if that indeed would be the case, it would be triggering back and forth, and those physicians who indeed did go into the fund would become vulnerable because they had given up their private insurance.
What if it was a one-time
70%? Yeah, a two-year commitment one time. You had to sign up for a minimum of 2 years, and you had to have a threshold of 50% before you ever clicked in.
Of how many, Wally?
Oh, I've been just reaching whatever would work out to make sure the fund is more likely to have enough money in it the other
side of that is that indeed the legislature will be meeting in 79. We will have a good handle on whether we
think we're correct or not the way it worked out, and that the legislature can say, okay, 50% came in, if you're correct, or 40 or whatever, if we're correct, 70 or whatever it is, turns out to be 80 or 90, and can say, we feel uncomfortable, the legislature feels uncomfortable, therefore either the physicians will pony up more money or there'll be a health premium tax or whatever alternative method of financing.
Yeah, but what have we done to, let's say 10% come in. We come back in 70, 79, and we take a look at it and we say it isn't working. What do we do with the 20% that you're worried about that are hanging out there slowly twisting in the wind? Do we do in the program and say, better get back on another program? Or do we, you know, I think we're going to have that risk no matter what we decide, I think, frankly, because mm-hmm. we can't guarantee that fund's going to work forever anyway. Mm-hmm. So
I think Senator Roberts was next here. I'm sorry.
There's no second tie, so that means that I get it. Well, my question is, what do you feel about mandating the doctor's participation in this program? In other words, having the state of Oregon essentially become sponsoring a self-insurance program for Oregon physicians.
You mean pick up the coverage from zero on up to the 100,000, or to just mandate
the program? That you must participate in this program.
The problem would be with that is that if indeed Les Rawls is correct and that sometime down the line CNA or St. Paul's or both leave the state, then you would have all the physicians vulnerable, no protection.
No,
if I understand your question correctly.
Well, I seem to be bad in
zero.
What I mean is that what about requiring that this be the insurance plan for physicians as opposed
to... As a condition to their right to practice medicine.
Exactly right.
This has been discussed off and on, and there's two things. The medical society per se is basically opposed to the state intervention at that point. Secondly, from a practical standpoint...
Why?
I suppose just because of the natural... Yeah.
You ever try to tell a doctor what to do?
I know.
It's their right to independence, I guess, is the basic thing that they're concerned with, and the state being involved with it. But
well, the insurance commission...
Independence to a point.
Yeah. So my concern...
Thing is fund under the state insurance commissioner, I suppose the doctors wouldn't care for that either.
9 or 10 cases a year isn't quite like having your license tied to it. But here's the thing.
It's best to make 100% commitment and then...
Here's the thing that you're doing. If you say your right to practice medicine is tied to your ability to buy a $100,000 insurance policy, it seems folly to do that at a time when no one is sure that you're going to be able to even buy insurance. And this is the reason why we're going to these extremes, because Travelers announced they're pulling out of Northern California.
Would it be hard to put an exemption clause into any such requirement, saying that so long as it's available, though, would it?
No, you could do that, but what have you accomplished then? I mean, do you have any...
Well, you've accomplished making it required so long as it's available.
The mandatory insurance? Who's going to set your standards then of underwriting? Some of the physicians can't get it. This is what Idaho tried to do.
Physicians that can't get insurance?
Yeah.
Why?
Because they have such bad claims records.
Well, maybe you guys should have taken them out already.
Well, us guys, the medical society, have taken them out. The Board of Medical Examiners, which is a state agency, is the one that has the right to pull their license. They are the ones that you gave more authority to last time. They are separate and distinct from the medical society.
I did.
And they have suspended licenses. Yes, they have.
But he just said there are people practicing that have such bad claims records that they can't get insurance.
Well, I think there are some of them.
They're all nice people, I'm sure. You know, I'm not trying to say anybody's not nice.
Well, let's work on something.
Mr. Chairman,
am I correct in assuming that the committee feels that there should be some backup funds? Is Senator Carson, do you feel that way?
Yes.
Also,
Where I'm leaning is Senator Trost.
Senator Trost, do you feel the same way? And Senator Wires?
Mr. Chairman, I think that they should be complimented for their approach. And I'm not, I personally don't think that this is a bad approach. I'm just trying to explore whether or not they have explored these other alternatives to resolve any question about the availability of money in this excess fund. And I would think that the question of participation seems to be the crucial one here. And that's what I'm trying to get at. I'm not opposed to the approach.
Senator Durnstead, do you have any comment?
Well, I haven't said anything, but I've been listening, and I think that the only way we're going to clear it up is for somebody to make a motion to the present bill. And then if that goes down, then we'd have to work from there. And I thought it just appears to me it might be an unpopular motion, but I'm going to make it.
Okay.
And then we'll see from there. So I move...
House Bill 3017
out
to the floor with a due pass
that's
recommendation.
That's the only way we're going
to
get a feeling for the committee.
Okay. Any further, any discussion?
Look, Chairman. That's the only way we'll find out if we can pass.
Clerk will go all the roll, Chairman.
There's one amendment. Yes. There's one amendment.
Before we do.
Wait.
I feel I should tell the committee then that I'm going to vote in support of the measure. I've never met Mr. Noble prior to the time he testified here. And the only reason I found out that I heard the committee members discussing his name, but my father-in-law is one of his clients, and I would not want that to be taken as a means of the determination of his bill, but I want to
make the other.
I want to make that aware that committee members before the vote is taken, so that somebody can't come back later and say that they had some personalities involved in it. But I am going to support the aid of this.
I was more curious about who that comes with.
Pardon me?
Yeah.
Okay. Before we accept that motion, let's go to page 2 on line 20. All of that material, as I recall, this amendment was an error made in the House side. And the bold type, and to assist at surgery at their own patients under the direct supervision of a primary surgeon, that should follow the word surgery on line 22. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Is there any, I will so move, is there any objection to that amendment? Hearing none,
Mr. Chairman, was that amendment again? To take that out?
You won't take it. You just move it down after
surgery on line 22.
Okay, hearing none. Hearing none, it is so ordered. Okay. Senator Durnstead moves House Bill 3017 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. The clerk will call the roll.
Senator Costin?
No.
Senator Hannan?
Aye.
Senator Durnstead?
Aye.
Senator Roberts?
Aye.
Senator Joel? Senator
Joe?
No.
Senator
Wyatt?
No.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye. Motion is carried.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to explain my vote. It was a hard vote for me. I will support the bill on the floor, but I did want to see some kind of guarantee that the fund would be adequate, and I really do hope that the doctors will get involved in the fund if we pass this bill and be in it so that when they come back, we've got 80 or 90% of them participating. And I wish you had come to us and said, you know, we poll the doctors, and they say that if you do this, we're going to take part. And you'd said, you know, we've got pledges from them.
we will do everything in our part to get the positions in. And
I want to say that
I plan to come back next session, Senator Trost, so if you will have a chance.
I feel the same way as Senator Trost, and I was reluctant to vote for the bill. And until we, and I'm going to be watching it very closely, and if it doesn't work, I'm going to be awful unhappy, and I think there's going to be a lot of unhappy legislators with the medical society.
Mr. Chairman, I feel that...
And I'd like to serve notice at this time.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to enter into the record that on an informal basis, informally as far as legislation is concerned, but formally as far as the Oregon Medical Association is concerned, that we indeed will pull our members, and that if we feel that we cannot get 50% of the practicing physicians of this state, which would exclude generally the medical school and Kaiser, we can't be responsible for, but we'd include those people in. If we can't get 50% of the physicians into this fund, then we indeed will not go into the fund and will come back for additional legislation in 79.
Are you accepting unlimited liability?
Well, I think that's a good guarantee, if you will.
We appreciate that.
Hold to that. We don't want to hurt you.
We are too, and we don't want to endanger anybody's claim.
We want to hurt you, we want to help you, but if you want,
I understand,
want to help yourself,
appreciate the committee's concern for this matter. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We did get to House Bill 2177, and we'll take it up at our next session tomorrow.
Who is going to carry it? Right, we're getting here somewhere where we are.